This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm George Levesque. The primary is over. Are you ready for a break from the ads? Well, some candidates still have plenty of work to do. We'll take a look at two races that have crowded rosters on the Republican ballot, the race for Texas House District 71 and Texas 19th congressional seat. KACU's Leslie Kerrigan will start us off.
Jay Hardaway sealed his spot as the Republican candidate for House District 71, beating out three other hopefuls, Liz Case, Chance Ferguson, and Joshua Olemaker. Hardaway said he attributed his success to classic campaign strategies, such as traveling around the district to meet voters, raising money, and good advertising. However, as he moves forward, he said he wanted to stay focused on the work that still needs to be done.
And, that's 42% people that chose somebody else. And so that's meetings, that's reaching out to other candidates and making sure their issues get heard. I mean, people act like the election is over now. We still have the general in November. And so, there's a lot of work to be made up between now and then.
Hardaway will face the sole Democratic candidate in the race, Diana Luna, in the November election. I'm Leslie Kerrigan in Abilene.
The other big race is the seven-candidate contest for the seat that's been held for the last decade by Jody Arrington. KTTZ's Brad Burt has helped us cover this race and has more on where things stand now.
With seven Republican candidates on the ballot, a runoff was highly anticipated. Early in the evening, Lubbock businessman and agriculture lobbyist Tom Sell came out as a leading contender.
It's certainly gratifying to see the votes rolling in, and looks like we'll be in a strong position for a runoff. And so we'll get to keep on doing this great campaign work and getting around and meeting more people, which is what I've really loved.
Much of the rest of the evening was an exchange for who would come in second between Abilene's Matt Smith and Abraham Enriquez. We caught up with Enriquez out at a polling location here in Lubbock on Election Day.
As the polls opened up, we've visited almost every polling location here in Lubbock. It's excitement, enthusiasm to know there are people coming out, and exciting time for our district. So, getting out here, speaking to voters, and sharing our campaign vision has been really great.
In the end, Enriquez did gain enough votes to earn his place in the runoff. The winner of the runoff will face Democrat Kyle Rabel for the seat in November. I'm Brad Burt in Lubbock.
And now McMurray political science professor Paul Fabrizio is ready to break down what's next. He spoke with KACU's Heather Claiborne about this wild primary season and what's coming up.
Let's start with the statewide races. It was a tough battle on both sides for the U.S. Senate race. James Talarico was able to claim victory outright, but vote counts are still being finalized. On the Republican side, John Cornyn has less than a one-point lead at this moment over Ken Paxton, so they're headed to a May runoff.
It's a bit of a surprise. So recent polls showed Ken Paxton in the lead and also showed Jasmine Crockett for the most part in the lead. There was some other polls that showed James Talarico ahead, but generally it showed that Crockett was doing better. But both races seem to solidify for Talarico and for John Cornyn in the last couple of days. There seemed to be a little bit of a pushback both at the local level and at the state level. And the pushback is against the Republican MAGA base. What you saw was John Cornyn, who's not part of MAGA, beating someone who was, Ken Paxton. And then you look at like the precincts here with the Republican Party, and some of the people who won at the like precinct chairs were people who were not affiliated with the MAGA base. So after Republican politics, I would argue, being dominated by Trump-affiliated MAGA supporters, there seems to be some pushback against that. And the more establishment Republicans made a bit of a comeback last night.
Well, looking over at the Republicans' race for the 19th congressional district, in politics, you follow the money. Tom Sell raised the most by far in this race and captured about 40%. Even though Abraham Enriquez easily claimed second spot in the money race, it was a close call for him to get the second spot for the runoff. He edged out Matt Smith by just a quarter of a percentage point. Is that surprising to you?
I think we had an idea from the money who was going to finish in the top three. And those who finished in the top three also had raised and spent the most money. So Tom Sells, last I saw, raised more than $1 million, $1.2 million, while Enriquez raised more than $400,000 and Matt Smith more than $350,000. So everybody else was in, you know, way below that, only in the tens of thousands of dollars raised, or even less than that. So I think there was an expectation those were going to be the top three people. And then it was just a question of what place they were going to be in. And it turned out, you know, we don't have complete money results, but it turned out the one who finished first spent the most money. The one who finished second spent the second most money. And so does that mean that money determines races? Money certainly helps an awful lot, especially when you look at this huge district. It includes Lubbock, it includes Abilene, and everything else in between. So it takes a lot of money to get your name known and to have any chance of success. So that's what we got. Now we've got a runoff coming, and the question is, will the person who finished first, Tom Sells, be able to translate his 40% of the vote into now a majority? And we'll see if he can finish first again. And we also going to see how much money he's willing to spend to carry him through. And Abraham Enriquez has got to figure out where he's going to raise more money so that he can compete with Tom Sells.
Well, looking ahead to that runoff, do you think there is a clear difference between Tom Sell and Abraham Enriquez as far as the issues go?
No, not at all. And see, that's the whole thing. If you really look at the issues, you look at all the candidates who are running, it's really hard to tell the difference between them. They're all generally for the same things. They support the same issues. And all of them were supporting President Trump. So the race really, to me, came down more to name recognition, and that is affected by how much money you raised. So the candidates who finished first and second were the ones who raised the most money. So can you really sit down and say, well, Enriquez supported this and Tom Sells supported that? Can you really tell that much difference? When they're going to be in Congress, they're going to vote pretty much the same. So it's going to be a conservative Republican either way. Voters are going to have to decide who they want to represent them. And that should be an interesting race. What will happen between now and then is the candidates will try to find some way to separate themselves from the other. And they're going to pick at little things that are different about them, and I don't know what those might be, and try to build them into big differences between them. But the reality is they're both conservative. They're both Republicans. They're both committed to President Trump's agenda.
As we heard just a few minutes ago, Jay Hardaway will be the Republicans' nominee to replace Dan Lambert, representing the 71st District in the Texas State House. The rest of the field, Chance Ferguson got 22%, Liz Kayes 18%, and Joshua Ullmacher just 3%. Were you surprised that race wasn't closer?
Only a little bit. Again, I'm going to point to the power of money. And, you know, I hate, in a certain sense, to be so crass as to say money determines who wins. But Jay Hardaway, and I have to be honest, Jay Hardaway is a former student of mine here at McMurray. Jay Hardaway outraised and outspent his opponents. What we were looking at yesterday in the financial reports showed that Jay Hardaway raised and spent about 90% of the money that was spent in this race. So when you're spending that kind of money, I think you have an expectation of success. And he clearly tried to run as the incumbent in the race and really tried to go for a knockout and make sure there wasn't going to be a runoff at all. And so in that sense, he was spectacularly successful. He he won by a huge margin, but he spent by a huge margin as well. So I don't know that surprise is the right word. Liz Case had run a credible campaign 2 years ago against Dan Lambert, but this was a different time. She didn't have the endorsement of the governor this time. The governor specifically came and endorsed Jay Hardaway instead. So Liz Case, you know, lacked the money, lacked the endorsements, so she wasn't able to overcome the tsunami of money that Jay Hardaway had. I mean, everybody I've talked to has received mailer after mailer from Jay Hardaway or from affiliated political action committees. I think I had brochures in my mailbox from five different political action committees, as well as the Hardaway campaign. I mean, it was hard by the voting day not to know that Jay Hardaway was the candidate. And the question was, who were the others? Because they just got overwhelmed by all this advertising that Hardaway was able to do.
Let's look ahead to the Democrats. There hadn't been a Democratic challenger for the congressional district since 2020, and now we have Kyle Rabel running against the winner of the runoff, and Diana Luna will face Jay Hardaway in the general election. The Democrats have been talking about building on the surprise in the special election a few weeks ago in Tarrant County. Is there anything they can do to close the gap with voters in this region?
First of all, they have to be present. They have to be out there. They have to make sure that voters know their name. Okay, so every opportunity that exists, they have to be present. They have to go door to door. They have to find the money to go and spend it on brochures, get it in people's mailboxes. But the biggest thing for the Democrats is really beyond their control. And that is going to be the larger question as we go farther into this year. Is this going to be a Democratic wave election where simply because you have a D after your name, voters are going to support you, and they're doing it because of opposition to the president and the president's party? And that's not something that local candidates can affect. It's something that just might happen. We know historically, in midterm races, the president's party loses seats. So we expect that to happen now. And you mentioned the Fort Worth Tarrant County race, you know, and we are looking at that as a sign that this might be a Democratic wave election. But even then, this is such an overwhelmingly Republican district, both at the congressional and the state house side, that it would be hard to imagine it could be such a wave election that a Democrat could overcome 60, 70 point difference in public opinion polls. That's a huge, huge leap. And I don't know if that is possible to do. So, you know, looking at this race objectively, both of these races objectively, what you have to say is that the Republicans, despite what might take place nationally, the Republicans are in charge, they're in command in West Texas. And it would take a huge earthquake for that to change.
Lastly, I wanted to ask you about turnout. There are about 6,000 more registered voters this time compared to 2022, which is the last comparable election. Early voting nearly doubled that election, but still only 23% of registered voters showed up. That's a lot of power for a small amount of the voting population.
Yeah, that is an unfortunate side of American politics, where so much of the action actually takes place in the primary, and most voters don't participate in it. I mean, it's sad, it's tragic. Voters who don't participate in these primaries are ceding power to those who do. And what often happens is for a candidate to win in the primary, if they're a Republican, they have to be more conservative to stand out. If they're a Democrat, they have to be more liberal to stand out. So this is just something that's cooked into the American political system. This is not anything new that you're talking about. It's been a factor for generations in American politics. I mean, here in Texas, when we used to be a Democratic state, all the action took place in the Democratic primaries. It didn't take place in the Democratic, in the general election. It took place in the primaries. So what we're doing is we're going back more than a century to have the same thing that you just described. I would argue it's what's taken place in terms of voter turnout is not a phenomenon. It's simply normal course of business. Voters who really want to participate, the most active voters, participate in the primaries. They're the ones who determine the candidates. And then in the general election in November, we'll have a greater turnout, but our choices were determined by what took place among a much smaller electorate.
Paul Fabrizio, thank you so much.
Thank you, Heather. I appreciate it.
That's KACU's Heather Claiborne speaking with McMurray political science professor Paul Fabrizio. Stay tuned to KACU for coverage of the local races through the coming runoffs, municipal elections, and the general election in November. It's the West Texas Dispatch. Mental health hotlines can be particularly valuable in rural areas where there are not many therapists or social workers close by. That includes 988. That's the National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. It launched less than 4 years ago and has already responded to, get this, 20 million contacts. But support for 988 is stronger in some states than others. Harvest Public Media's Michael Marks has more.
The 988 system was designed to give people in crisis an easy-to-remember number that's available 24 hours a day. Every state has its own set of call centers with trained operators, and since the hotline started taking calls in 2022, demand has increased nationwide.
We have been seeing a month-over-month increase in utilization of 988. And so we are also working pretty hard to keep up.
That's Monica Kurz, Chief Administrative Officer for Health Source Integrated Solutions in Kansas, one of the state's 988 call centers. She says the service is a necessity for rural Kansans.
We know that in our rural and frontier counties in Kansas, folks might be traveling hours to get to their nearest mental health clinic. And this is a way to access services right away without that kind of distance barrier.
Responding quickly is essential. A caller frustrated with a long wait time might hang up. Plus, if they spend 2 minutes on hold, the call is rerouted from a local facility to a national backup center. A backup operator may not be able to connect someone with local resources, says Lauren Moyer, chair of Missouri's 988 Task Force.
If someone is really struggling with substance use and needs connected to a residential substance use bed in the moment, somebody from another state is not going to have access to that information.
When the 988 hotline launched, the federal government paid for it, but states were expected to pick up the tab eventually. That has not happened in Texas yet. Jennifer Battle is vice president of the Harris Center in Houston, which fields 988 calls. During a legislative hearing last year, she said the state's call centers get around 200,000 calls annually, and the state needs to step up and help fund the program.
As impressive as these numbers are that we're able to serve with the current federal funds, these funds only allow for us to be able to answer on average 84% of the 988 calls that originate in Texas.
The federal 988 bill recommended that states pay for the program through fees on telecommunication products. That's how 911 is largely funded. Only a dozen have done so, including Minnesota and Illinois. But in Missouri, they're doing things a little differently, dedicating money from the state's general fund each year. Lauren Moyer, the Missouri State Task Force chair, worries about sustainability.
You know, general revenue support, it's its own line item, and that's not guaranteed long term.
Oklahoma doesn't have a recurring fee to support 988 either. According to State Representative Kevin Norwood, a Republican from the Tulsa area, there's little appetite in the state legislature for a new tax.
Before I became a legislator, that idea was introduced and it gained no traction.
Norwood is now sponsoring a bill that would create a trust fund for 988, which would ensure the money is only used for the hotline.
When I jumped into it, I was like, okay, we need to make it where it's not just a short-term fix, that it would be long-term and sustainable.
Texas has followed a similar path. Lawmakers there have been unable to pass the telecommunications fee through the legislature. In 2025, Texas established a trust fund, but the balance is currently zero. Jonathan Pertle studies 988 funding at the New York University School of Global Public Health.
Those trust funds are a strategy, but if there's not funds in the trust fund, it's not going to have that much of an impact. But it's something that some states are trying. It's a signal of effort, I suppose.
Pertle is near the end of a five-year study. He's analyzing the funding of 988 systems in all 50 states. So far, he's found that those with long-term dedicated funding for staff are generally more efficient.
The big thing is people, right? The staffing, the people to work in these call centers is the main thing.
He may have a new data point in the near future. Missouri's legislature is set to consider a 988 funding fee later this year. I'm Michael Marks, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a collaboration of public newsrooms in the Midwest and Great Plains, including KACU. When it comes to health insurance, Texas has the highest rate of uninsured residents in the nation, around 20%. Experts estimate concerns about costs lead thousands of uninsured Texans to put health care on the back burner. But there is care available for individuals and families here who don't have health insurance. KACU's Bailey Simon has more on the resources available to the uninsured of Taylor County and surrounding areas.
When an uninsured person waits too long to seek medical treatment, a problem that was initially manageable can develop into a serious and expensive emergency. That's according to Brady Harwell, executive director of the Presbyterian Medical Care Mission.
Hospitals, you know, they see patients, they provide care for them without the expectation that that individual is going to be able to cover or pay that service. And so they have to figure out a way in which to offset those losses with those individual patients that can't, you know, pay their bills.
Rural hospitals especially struggle to offset the cost of uninsured patients. A recent analysis done by the health consulting firm Chartis shows that in 2025, 46% of rural hospitals in the U.S. operated in the red. And that fact's had a profound impact on Texas. Since 2010, the state has led the nation in the number of these rural facilities that have closed or reduced services. Harwell's clinic, the Presbyterian Medical Care Mission, serves Taylor County and 18 surrounding rural counties. Its goal is to give uninsured and low-income patients needed medical care and prescriptions before manageable problems become huge issues.
I don't think that enough people know that we are a resource available to folks that are on the uninsured side.
Services are available to uninsured individuals who are at or below three times the federal poverty level of around $15,000.
We definitely don't want to be the best kept secret in Abilene. We want to get the word out to anybody and everyone that needs medical care, needs prescriptions.
He says last fiscal year, they obtained nearly $7 million worth of medication for their patients. And being a charitable clinic, the mission can tap into benefits that pharmaceutical companies have specifically for the uninsured.
The vast majority of patients can actually have those medications directly shipped to their home. And when that takes place, we charge $0. So they're literally getting months of medications at a time for no cost to them.
In total, a visit to the Presbyterian Medical Care Mission costs around $50. That covers being seen by a physician, lab work, and medications. Beyond that clinic, lower-income residents of Taylor County are also eligible for the Abilene Public Health District's Charity Care Program. And the health district has other state-funded programs available to residents who do not live in Taylor County. Carrie Waller is the director of nursing at the health district.
We do live in what's considered a family planning desert.
She says many women who don't know where to start with family planning or can't afford birth control come in for help.
One of our more popular clinics is our women's clinic and our STD clinic. and it is because the care is not available anywhere else.
STD services are accessible through the Charity Care Program. Those above its income thresholds can still get services for a $25 copay. Abilene's Public Health District also provides breast and cervical cancer screens through the Healthy Texas Women's Program, plus family planning services to eligible patients aged 15 through 44. This state-funded program is slightly more selective, but Waller says there's also an affordable self-pay option for patients who do not qualify for free care.
We're going to work you up as a case, regardless of whether you're insured or uninsured.
Abilene's Health District offers several other services, like immunizations, laboratory tests, and dental care. And it's not just this area of Texas where free or low-cost health care is available for the uninsured. The statewide website, 211texas.org, provides patients with a list of medical options available to them by zip code. To get an appointment set up, most clinics will ask patients to provide a pay stub and some type of proof of residence or ID. I'm Bailey Simon in Abilene.
Bailey's story was produced in partnership with the West Texas Tribune. This is the West Texas Dispatch. The Trump administration's plan for border wall building across the Big Bend region, including in the Big Bend National Park, has sparked widespread opposition in West Texas. Local residents and businesses, state lawmakers, even a local Republican sheriff, have all said the plan just doesn't make sense for the uniquely rugged and remote corner of Texas. One notable voice speaking out is the man who used to lead Big Bend National Park just a few years ago. Bob Krumenacker was the park superintendent from 2018 to 2023 and now helps lead a group supporting a wilderness designation plan for the park called Keep Big Bend Wild. Marfa Public Radio's Travis Bubenik caught up with Krumenacker for his thoughts on the plan.
The general idea of border wall building in the Big Bend has, of course, come up before in the past, but never really gone anywhere. So I'm curious, what was your reaction when you saw that map of these so-called smart wall projects that shows that border barriers are now a real possibility in the park?
I was appalled. I was scared. I was motivated to try to do something. This is potentially the biggest threat, not just to Big Bend National Park, but maybe to the entire integrity of the national park system since they built a dam in Yosemite National Park more than a century ago. This is huge.
What are you most concerned about in terms of the potential environmental impacts of wall building in the park?
The river is vital to the experience of the people who visit, but obviously to the plants and animals in the park as well. So in no particular order, the cutting off of the river for access by people and maybe more importantly in the long run for wildlife. The black bears, which are so loved and vital to the ecosystem of the park, they came across from Mexico. Any wall that is big enough to deter humans from crossing would also have the same impact on black bears and many other wildlife. There's a huge impact on the night sky. Big Bend National Park and the surrounding area and the state park and Brewster and other counties nearby are the darkest night skies in the lower 48. And they've been internationally recognized for that. And as far as I know from looking at the wall in New Mexico and other places and reading online what Customs and Border Protection has indicated they might do, because we don't really know what they will do, there will be lights along that wall. But you know, the other thing that's environmental that isn't getting a lot of play is the fact that cultural resources are likely to be very seriously impacted. I mean, the river has been the center of ecological and human use for as long as humans have been in this area. And then if they're going to figure out how to build something so massive, they've got to bring in hundreds of people who have to stay the night somewhere. Is there enough water either in Terlingua or in Big Bend National Park to support a community of 300 to 500 people? I don't think so.
I feel like one immediate question a lot of people probably had about all this is just, can they do this in a national park? I mean, you can't even drive off a designated road in Big Bend without getting in trouble. So what kind of national park rules, regulations could complicate this plan?
Sadly, probably none. The Department of Homeland Security has the authority under several acts that Congress has passed over the years that essentially allow for the purposes of border wall construction, the waiving of virtually every other federal law that stands in the way. So National Park Service laws, National Park Service regulations, people aren't allowed to pick flowers in the national park, but Homeland Security, if they pursue this, would probably be legally allowed to do it, much to my chagrin.
And I'll note that we haven't seen those environmental waivers for the national park yet, though we have seen them for other sections of the Big Bend region where DHS has outlined this smart wall plan, but that could change.
It could change, and it is curious. They obviously don't publish their strategy ahead of time, so we don't know if that's a signal to suggest they're just floating the idea to see what the reaction is or whether that will just follow. But we know that the state park is in the bullseye upstream, and they have waived the environmental laws there, so it's hard to imagine that there's any reason they would stop at the state park.
Just anecdotally, I have been seeing a fair amount of commentary, online commentary in response to reporting on this in recent days, along the lines of, don't worry, this will never actually happen. Even if it is on a map and CBP says it is pursuing border security upgrades across the region, some folks think they'll never actually build a wall in the park. What do you say to that?
I hope they're right, but I learned a long time ago, hope is not a strategy. It seems to me that this administration is typically very upfront about what it's going to do. And ever since the beginning of the first Trump administration, people have said, oh, that won't happen. And many of those things have happened. So I think it won't happen, but I think it won't happen only because of the outrage and organizing and pressure, bipartisan, that the people of Texas and especially West Texas are mobilizing to object to this. And so I think it's a full court press until and unless Homeland Security announces they are not going to do this.
Bob Krumenacher, former superintendent of Big Bend National Park, speaking to Marfa Public Radio's Travis Bubenik. It's time for West Texas Roots. We had the pleasure of talking to a lot of people at the Texas Farm Ranch and Wildlife Expo last month. We've got great stories of West Texas coming your way. Delaine Rutan shared some of her memories of growing up on her family's cotton farm in Rotan, and one, how a big rainstorm created a lot of extra work for these Fisher County farmers.
I grew up in Rotan, Texas, and my dad was a cotton farmer, and he had a few cattle. And in the summers, from when I was in second grade on, we would hoe, and our whole family would go out and hoe. We would hoe all morning, take a break, and then we'd hoe in the afternoon. So we usually spent 6-7 hours hoeing. He had his own field, and then he rented out and farmed others. And mainly it was from the family farm that had been passed down from even uncles and my granddad and stuff, and that he had bought out from them. And that's one thing I always remember about my dad. He bought the house and the land, and it took him 3 years to pay it off, because that was the first thing he would do is, if you owe somebody, the money's not yours. So he made sure he paid off as quick as he could. And there were years we did without. We barely had anything, but we always had enough. And we learned what hard work was, and we learned to get somewhere you needed to work hard, that it's not just going to be given to you. And I love to this day to be out on the land just walking and looking. And that's some of the stuff my dad gave to us. One year, it was in the 70s, probably the early 70s up to mid maybe, and there was a big rain, and there's a Brazos River flows through there, and there's a river bridge, and it's north of town, and it rained so much that it come up over the bridge probably 12 inches or so. And so for the fields to dry out, they had terraces back then, And so for the fields to dry out, it took weeks and weeks and weeks. And by the time we were able to get back in the field to hoe, the weeds were at least 6 to 7 foot tall. And they were really big around. They weren't the normal little half to 1 inch. They were at least 2 to 3 inches around at bottom. And so we would hoe down a row. It would, my mom and the three kids, while my dad was plowing, and four kids, I'm sorry, he planted two in and four out. And so it would take us 2 hours just to get down that row. And the careless weeds were just out of control. I mean, it was solid careless weeds. You could barely find the cotton from that. Dad would have pasture land and he needed more so we could survive, he would grub it himself. So nowadays they have people that do it, but he would go in there and with his tractors and stuff, and he would knock down the trees, and we, the mesquite trees, and we'd drag them to where they go, and then he would light them on fire and they'd burn, and then when all that burned down, we'd go clean up the ashes and the rest of the rubble, and then he would keep working that land until it was good for either the cotton, sometimes he would do hay grazer and stuff for the cattle, but yes, and he would keep working it and getting the terraces on all on it and just keep a working.
We recorded Delaine Rutan's story of the Sparks Family Farm at the Taylor County Expo Center. This is the West Texas Dispatch. A new coffee shop in downtown Abilene is blending more than just Frappuccinos. Scenic Route gives customers a space to explore their artistic side while satisfying their hunger and their thirst. KACU's Leslie Kerrigan brings us their story.
When the owners of Sway Cafe and Wine Bar announced in December that they would be passing the torch to new owners, lots of loyal customers were left wondering what would happen to the bright, modern spot that brewed their favorite coffees and sandwiches. The questions were answered when Scenic Route opened its doors on Pine Street. The cafe still serves coffees, sandwiches, and pastries, and now with a side of art. While enjoying their lattes, patrons can make a craft by painting, drawing, or beading. Kelsey Savage, one of the owners, says their vision is to provide their guests with a lot of different ways to get creative.
So you would come in and you would pick up, like, your base. It could be decorating a tote bag, painting on a canvas, making jewelry, painting ceramics, decorating gift bags. So you would just come in and you get with the barista and let them know what main project you get, and then go over there and then at our craft bar, just all the supplies, everything we need.
While not currently available, they also plan to add collaging and junk journaling, a form of scrapbooking using recycled or handmade materials. Kelsey Savage is partnering with Melissa Dean on this venture. Savage had previous experience working as a barista and Dean as an artist. Dean explains that the idea first began to take shape last year when they decided to teach an art class.
We both worked for other people, for corporations, and like Party City, I was a store manager, and they decided to close. Mm-hmm. So I was like, I don't know if I really want to work for anybody else again. Mm-hmm. And we got together and we're like, let's do an event where we did junk journals and taught people how to junk journal.
Dean and Savage taught a variety of art classes, like decoupage, terracotta pots, beading, ceramics, tote bag painting, and bookmark decorating at local small businesses. One of the coffee shops they regularly taught at was Sway. After months of teaching, the owners approached Dean and Savage to see if they would be interested in buying the cafe. The transition took a couple of months as the new owners put their own mark on the space. As a way to give back to the community, they are now partnering with local artists who will come and teach their own artistic skills at the new cafe. Although, Savage and Dean still plan to occasionally teach their own classes as well.
The Abilene community helped us out so much that I want to do that for other people. Mm-hmm. And so right now I'm just focusing on letting other people rent out our space. Right now we're scheduling people that they can do it.
The duo plans to post their schedule of art classes on social media for people looking for some guidance in fun projects. While the cafe is focused on art, Dean emphasized that people can also come in to do more than crafts. They've stocked some board games, and there's plenty of room for business meetings or just hanging out with friends.
I think our mission is to give people that third space to take a break from work, life, social media, to just the world.
Ultimately, Dean says she and Savage hope the cafe helps people find a place outside of work and home to relax and connect with people. I'm Leslie Kerrigan in Abilene.
And we leave you some thoughts from our friend Glenn Drumgoole.
When it comes to special interest groups, I have to admit to being in one that is rapidly declining. In fact, you never see our special interest group represented in census data or political polls or quality of life surveys. We are the forgotten Americans who like liver and onions. Yes, liver and onions, calf liver, smothered in sautéed onions and brown gravy. You used to find us lined up at Luby's or other cafeterias, but now the cafeterias are pretty much a thing of the past, and so are liver and onions. In Abilene, liver and onions are offered at only one place I've found, and they're not all that good. I have to drive about 75 miles to get a decent serving. My wife doesn't like liver and onions. My kids don't like liver and onions. My friends don't like liver and onions, but I do. Maybe you do too. If so, order them whenever you can and thank the cafe owner for standing up for our rights as liver-loving Americans. This is Glenn Drumgoole for the West Texas Dispatch.
Glenn is the author of 36 books and the proprietor of Texas Star Trading Company, which he owns with his wife, Carol. This has been the West Texas Dispatch. We're glad you joined us. We'll be back next Wednesday at noon. Plan to be here. And you can listen to the podcast anytime. The West Texas Dispatch is available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can also find it on the KACU mobile app. Our executive producer is Heather Claiborne. We had help this week from producer Caleb Legere and our digital editor, Calvin Claiborne. I'm George Levesque.